Okay, this is the podcast on Senghor, and the two poems we're looking at from him, Black Woman and Prayer to the Masks. If you look at the biographical information about Senghor, you see that he starts out as this supremely superb student, right? Not the kind of student that the French colonials would have expected to see. He tries his hand at the seminary, he's thinking he wants to become a priest, but leaves because of the racism of the priests there, right? Which means that he is, in fact, Roman Catholic in a country that is, at the time he's growing up, 98 or 99% Muslim, right? And people, they vote for and with co-religionists, right? So he is in a definite, absolute minority. Right? At the time, he's part of the French colonies of West Africa. Eventually, that place is going to get called Senegal, right? And he, he wins a scholarship to a regular school, and then wins a scholarship to the secondary school, high school in Dakar, and then a scholarship to the same place that Voltaire went to school, which is the Lycée Louis le Grand in Paris, still one of the greatest places in, one of the greatest schools in all of Europe. There he meets Césaire and Damas, the guys that we talked about earlier in terms of negritude. He earns his bachelor's degree and not only outperforms, all the other colonials, because they were certainly looked upon with disdain by the French at that time, but he's also the first African to gain the highest degree, the Agrégation de Grammaire. Almost immediately after his graduation, he begins military service and starts teaching in various schools in France. And it's during these late 30s when they really develop this idea of negritude. When World War II is inevitable, he enlists in the colonial infantry and becomes a prisoner of war, where he remains in a German concentration camp for 2 years. A prisoner of war camp, not a concentration camp. He's eventually released in a prisoner exchange and confined to Paris. He resumes teaching, and then once the war is over in 45, he's elected to the French equivalent of the House of Representatives as the representative for Senegal, this colonial place. Once there, these men who really don't have kind of same resentment towards colonials as the educational system did, they recognize just how good he is. And he becomes the official grammarian for the drafting of the new French Constitution. The official grammarian but essentially means he writes the French Constitution. And not only that, in about 15 years, he's going to rewrite it. He's the guy that every other elected official in France trust to handle the idea of human rights, trust to handle the idea of articulating what France itself as a nation is going to be about. He gets married a couple times, divorced a couple times, right? And by 1958, drafts another French constitution. And in 1960, when the French finally release Senegal and create an independent nation there, right? He's elected president. Think about that. In a minority of 1%, maybe at max 2% of the population, he's elected by the majority of the population. He ran against tons of Muslims, right? But he was the man that everyone in Senegal knew. Now, did he do good work? Yes. Did he do bad work? Yes. He hangs on to power a little too long. I mean, look at that. He's in the presidency for 21 years. This is not a good thing. He declares almost one of the very first things he does is that he says, our democracy is fragile, and therefore we can have no kind of, we are going to be a one-party system. We can have no opposition. That's a bad move, right? Because that leads to demagoguery, that leads to dictatorships. And there are people who will argue that Senghor himself, borders on that dictatorship. But he, let's realize that he has almost nothing to work with. The natural resources in Senegal are poor. They're right below the Sahara Desert, which is even now spreading further and further south into Senegal. They don't have, you know, their primary crops are like peanuts, not diamonds, not oil, not things that the world really clamors for at that time, right? However, he is able to mobilize these people. He's able to get things started. Right? He's able to create a decent living for most Senegalese. I spent some time there in 2010 and realized, you know, we're still kind of, they're still suffering the effects of the fact that the natural resources that they did have were taken for so long by colonizers that it's tough for them to get, you know, to get started, to create a decent standard of living across the board. It's a very rural place. With a place like Dakar, its capital, the westernmost point in absolutely all of Africa, the closest place to the New World. And so it, for years, it was a big slaving hub, right? It was the last view that slaves would have of Africa as they were sent through the Middle Passage. In 81, he finally resigns the presidency. He finally kind of maybe 5, 6, 7 years too late. He should have done it earlier. In 84, France declares that he's a member of the French Academy, the 40 immortals, the 40 greatest intellectuals in the history of France. He's the first African, first colonized, yes, the first colonial to be a part of that. Even Albert Camus isn't part of that before Senghor is. In 1996, UNESCO, which is United Nations, which is basically the cultural side of the United Nations, does for the first time ever in its life, when Senghor turns 90, they hold a three-day worldwide festival in celebration of his 90th birthday. They had never done that for anyone before, right? He is so important to the history of Africa, right? And from my perspective, all the while he's so important politically, he's also this decent poet as well. I mean, he's really kind of superb in his poetry. Right? You see that he dies in 2001. And you see the link at the bottom of that page to the two poems. Now, you can read those two poems in the Norton Anthology, but let me tell you, it's not that the translations are bad, but some of those glosses and notes there are pretty bad. I just want to point out a few of those that might be difficult for you. So for instance, let's look at Black Woman first, right? And as I read this, know that my translation is probably going to be different than what's in the Norton's. Mine's done by a French speaker who we worked together and I think came up with a more direct translation here. Clothed with the second line of Black Woman, naked woman, Black woman, clothed with your color that is life, with your shape that is beauty. Right? Your gloss says that that this woman is clothed in green. Well, let's look at how nonsensical that gloss is, right? What does the first line tell us? She's naked, which means that she's black. She's clothed with the color that is life. Well, black is the color that is life here. She's not, they're not saying green clad woman, they're saying naked woman. And so here she is, clothed only in her skin, and that color is life. Think about kind of the typical way we think of the black-white dichotomy, right? The bad guys wear black hats, the good guys wear white hats. White is the color of life, the color of resurrection, the symbol of the lily, right? And black is the color of death, the color of mourning. Negritude reverses that dichotomy, that binary opposition there, and says that no, black is also the color of life. And her shape is beautiful. It doesn't fit European standards, right? But it's beautiful nonetheless. And I grew up here, right? In the heart of this summer at high noon, I discover you, promised land, from the top of a charred hill. Promised land, nice little biblical reference, right? In the heart of summer at high noon, and also a reference both to the beginning of Dante's Inferno, which we saw with Prufrock, and also a reference to this notion that using diurnal and seasonal imagery here, as Keats does in To Autumn and in La Belle Dame Sans Merci, to compress life into both a year and a day in the heart of summer, meaning at the midpoint of life, at kind of at the height of my powers, at high noon, right, to the midpoint of the day, again, the height of my powers, I discover you, promised land, capitalized, promised land. The biblical imagery there about Israelites wandering in the desert, getting to Canaan, the land of milk and honey, right, becomes significant here. From the top of a charred hill, a nod to the slash and burn traditional agriculture, right? We do it around Statesboro. You can see it. We just did it during the usually in April or May. You burn off the crops that you're not, that right, what's been left in the field after harvesting, and that ash serves to replenish nutrients back into the soil. She then becomes there, right, these great descriptors, ripe fruit with firm flesh, shadowed raptures of black wine, mouth that makes mine lyrical, and then this kind of connection that Senghor is going to keep on making throughout this poem, is this woman is Africa, savanna of clear horizons, grassland, fields, right, savanna shuddering at the loving touch of the east wind. Now, we're going to see her shuddering at the loving touch of the east wind, and we're going to see something else happening when she's touched by the colonizer later on. But she is a sculpted tom-tom, this djembe, this drum, right? And here she is taught tom-tom, crying out under the conqueror's hands. Now, your gloss says moaning under the, I mean, your translation says moaning under the hands of the conqueror. For me, the implication of moaning is you moan in pleasure, usually, right? Especially under the hands of someone, right? As if this is some form of sexual union. I think it's more crying out or sounding, groaning, right? A qui gronde sous le droit de vainqueur is from the French, right? Who grinds or ground sounds, under the droit, the fingers of the conqueror, right? She's being played and she's sounding. Your deep contralto voice is the spiritual song of the beloved. And probably the worst gloss in that entire anthology on that line right there. Your deep contralto voice, comparing this to Marian Anderson? The mere fact that Marian Anderson is a black woman who happens to sing in the alto register, right? And she becomes famous for some other things, right? She becomes famous because she sings on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial when the Daughters of the American Revolution refused to let her, a black woman, sing in Constitution Hall. And Eleanor Roosevelt then says, you're going to sing here at the Lincoln Memorial, right? It becomes a big event for civil rights. 2 decades before civil rights become a real hot topic here in the United States. Your deep contralto voice is the spiritual song of the beloved. That spiritual song of the beloved is a reference to the Song of Songs, right? Another biblical image here, right? It's not about Marian Anderson. It's about this gorgeous woman, right? These four erotic poems of the Song of Songs that are in the Old Testament, right? Where the divine commingles with the human, a la Yeats again. Right here, that's the voice of the beloved, beloved by God, right? Naked woman, dark woman, oil that no breath ruffles, oil calming the muscles of athletes, the muscles of Mali princes. Now in Senegal, the kind of national sport is wrestling. Not WWE wrestling, not that fast, but Greco-Roman wrestling, they wouldn't call it Greco-Roman, but that type of wrestling. Everything from villages sending forth champions to kind of fight one another, to wrestle one another for civic pride, to national events. Think of it like the NFL or Major League Baseball. It's that popular there. And what these guys always do is they're constantly oiling themselves down so that their opponents can't get a grip on them. This becomes a big thing, right? Oil is also a sign of honor. Kings are anointed with oil or chrism, or the Mali princes, right? The Mali Empire used to encompass part of Senegal, right? Here again, this idea that it becomes like they are not only cleansed, but they are chosen for this as well. Gazelle, fastened to the firmament, right? The firmament, right? This she becomes a constellation of stars. The gazelle, one of the denizens of those savannas, those grasslands, right? But she becomes like a constellation there, placed up in the sky, that apotheosis of a poet. Remember Yeats, when you are old and gray and full of sleep, right? Love hiding his face amid a crowd of stars. Well, this is that apotheosis of this woman. She is fastened to the firmament, and pearls are stars on the night of your skin. All right. Then we see her in the firelight, the gold red on her shimmering skin, and the shadows of her hair, the twin suns of her eyes. And then this kind of little conclusion here that he does, that he's playing the exact same thing that Eliot did and that Akhmatova did. I sing your beauty that passes, a form I fix for eternity, right? I am writing this entire poem is about how beautiful you are, and I have fixed it. Because you know what? Tomorrow or next day, next year, in a decade, you're not going to be this beautiful. But I've fixed it. I've made this fixed point. I've turned it into art. And so I have created something that will fix it for all eternity before jealous fate turns you to ashes to nourish the roots of life. Remember those ashes we saw way back up there? The charred hill on line 5, right? Yes, life, death, and this is, remember, this is decades before this idea of the circle of life gets Disneyfied through the Lion King, right? This is far more significant, and one of the crucial points of Negritude, this idea that this understanding of death in the place of life, right, in the place of the circle of life. Yes, jealous fate will eventually turn you to ashes, but that your death will nourish the roots of life again. Think of how Whitman wants those atomic connections with us as well, right? Playing with these great ideas. And the same thing is happening in Prayer to the Masks. These masks, if you look at it, there are some serious notes at the bottom of that page with pictures, right? A person who wears a ritual mask, conceptually, if not ontologically, loses his or her human identity and takes on the spirit of whatever that mask is. Right? It could be an ancestor, could be kind of a protective natural figure, could be one of the divine beings. They're known as legbas, or horses that are ridden by these spirits. And so if you see the page on the Igungun masks, which you also can get to through the teaching site, look under Cultures and Histories for the Igungun masks, you'll see the idea that these cover entire bodies so that people aren't, you know, so that you deal with the spirit and not with the human being that is totally covered. And here, Senghor is doing the same thing, right? Talking about these masks, black, red, black and white, masks of the four corners where the spirit blows, talking about a little image from cartography there that you can see in the notes. I am saluting you. I am writing to you. I am speaking to you in silence, right? And you, ancestor with the lion's head, you keep this place safe from any women's laughter. Well, the idea that there are, as there are in American cultures, not as many, but in traditional African cultures, the idea that certain things are single gender, right? There are certain things that men only do, certain things that women only do, certain things that where men are not allowed or women are not allowed. And here, there's this mask as he says, you keep this place safe from any women's laughter, right? So women aren't allowed here. It seems like he's writing from a ritual place, a passage place where some, you know, kind of transition to manhood might take place. You distill this eternal essence where I breathe the air of my fathers. You basically allow me to step back into the past. You have rarefied this, right? And you, all my ancestors, here's what you've done. You've painted this portrait, and this portrait, he says, is my face bending over this altar of white paper, right? You have made me who I am. I am your progeny. Right? And this great idea of my face bending over this altar of white paper. Right? What is he doing? He's an author. And so he sits in front of this piece of white paper or this stack of white paper, and it becomes this altar. Right? What do you do on an altar? You offer a sacrifice. And here, this paper becomes his sacrifice. And what becomes a sacrifice, what he lays on this altar, is his words, his poem. This poem itself, so we get that whole modernist self-referential again, right? You've made me, and I'm making this my sacrifice to you. With your faces, hear me, right? Because here's what's happening. The Africa of empires is dying. It's the agony of a pitiful princess, right? This princess in childbirth, right? And if we die, Europe dies with us, for we are bound by the navel, right? We, right, Africa, like our child is Europe. Right? We know this biologically. Look at the notion of mitochondrial Eve, but we also know this that right, there is a maternal connection there, right? We're bound by the navel, and we're being killed by our own children. Right? Fix the, as he tells these masks, your unmoving eyes on your oppressed children who give their lives like the poor their last garments. And you need to read the gloss for that, because it's a little explanatory. And so, right, at the new Renaissance, at the rebirth of the world, at the beginning of the new Jerusalem, let us say present, let us say we're here too, right? We're as necessary as leaven for the white flour. And there's that biblical image too there, right? That flour needs its leaven. Go be salt, be leaven, right? That is what you're supposed to do. Because this world that has become deadened by machines and guns, we will teach it how to be human again. We will sound the cry of joy to wake the dead and the orphaned at daybreak, right? That idea of the last trumpet, right? We're the ones who will carry this forth. Who's going to bring back the memory of life to the man of gutted hopes? We are. And those Europeans, they call us men of cotton, coffee, and oil. They call us men of death because we're black, because we die because of our mortality rates and things like that. But we're men of dance, right? We're the people who can bring something new and human back into the world, whose feet come to life again by pounding the firm ground. And we can talk about the mythical reference there to Antaeus, who could not be beaten as long as he was in contact with the earth. He was that connected to the earth. Right. This great idea here, this mixture of modernist and these kind of almost little romantic ideas, this projection and promotion of primitivism right there, that this is the state of what Africans are or should be, right? And if we claim our place, we kind of fulfill the promise of negritude when we do so.